Hello, this is Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review for August 22nd, 2016. We will begin today's reading on the front page with an article headlined, Happiness Down to a T for Disabled Veterans. This is an article written by Tony Reed, Herald and Review staff writer. Veteran golfers know all about strokes and handicaps, and some of them know a lot more than they ever wished to. But a new golf project that teed off in Decatur a year ago, Veterans and Friends, welcomes them all to come out and play through their problems. It's open to military veterans, able-bodied and otherwise, and any civilians seeking to golf, despite some handicap in their lives. Players in this bracket range from stroke patients left with one good arm to amputees who have lost a leg. Veterans and Friends offers them play at the bargain rate of $10 with golf cart at venues that include the Scoville, Red Tail Run, and Hickory Point golf courses in Decatur and Moequa Golf Course. Players can also have a helper to assist them, and they also qualify for the reduced rates. It's a well-thought-out system that sees the more than 30 players golfing on set weekdays at each of the courses. They are matched up so golfers of similar ability or dealing with similar issues can play through at their own pace. No one, however, has to hang around too long waiting for players such as Phil Young, even though a stroke left the Decatur man with one good golfing arm, his right. A sharp metallic thwack announces another little white ball launched toward the green with a one-handed shot that is poetry in motion to behold. Once I never thought I would play again, says Young, 50, whose smile is as rich as the verdant grass of the Scoville course. But Veterans and Friends gets you back playing again. I love it. His golfing partner is the man whose misfortune started it all and turned into something wonderful. Keen Decatur golfer Ernie Jones thought his favorite pastime was history when he suffered a stroke in February 2014, and the right-handed player lost much of the use of his right arm. But Ernie's brother Dale saw it as a challenge, not a calamity. He knew one-handed golfers were out there and began researching all he could to learn how they played and the revised techniques of balance and poise that must be mastered. Ably assisted by another Jones brother, David, the siblings set to work to teach Ernie how to golf again. David and I worked with him all summer of 2014, says Dale Jones, 63. We had to hold him up by his belt at first while he learned to balance, but he learned. David Jones says much of it is about retraining the mind to use so a body that can't move the way it used to can learn. Sometimes you have to slow your mind down to let your body catch up. That is what we found out, he adds. Whatever they learned, it worked. Ernie, 66, got back to his beloved game and a new lease on life. Watching him play toward joy, a bright idea turned on in the mind of Dale Jones. I thought there has got to be more people like my brother out there, and so in the spring of 2015, I went to see Joe. That's Joe Hamill, the professional who manages Scoville. Meeting with him and Curtis Rogers, the Decatur Park District's director of golf, they swung out a format to help handicapped golfers and extend a welcome to veterans as a thank you for their service. It all began at Scoville, and the other courses came on board. It wasn't a hard sell. I couldn't say yes fast enough, says Brad Burcham, the golf professional at the Moequa course. Joe Hamill says it's a nice way to give something back to people who need a break or deserve some consideration for having served their country. And he says it's also a slice of enlightened self-interest for courses where weekday life can get a little lonely as general interest in the game has hit a rough patch in the past few years. Before these guys with Veterans and Friends started playing at Scoville Monday afternoons, there was nobody here, he says. Now, they are out here having a great time, and it's like money falling out of the sky for us. Hamill has also been willing to drive the extra mile to help in any way he can, putting a huge basement collection of used clubs, bags, and gear at Dale Jones' disposal to use as loaners. Jones, a retired railroad trainman and die-hard golfer, is also pretty handy with his hands. As well as running the program, he has customized clubs to get around individual golfers' disabilities. We've got guys missing their legs, we've got guys missing a foot, blind in one eye, and we've got back surgeries, and we've had open heart surgeries and hip replacements, he recalls. All folks are welcome, and we can work with them all. Back out on the Scoville course, a group of his veteran players are busy launching a successful assault on prime objective, a fun afternoon. Navy veteran Roy Rush, 85, is playing alongside fellow Navy man Leroy Wilson. Army veteran Andy Bachman and Marine veteran Elmer Rogers. There are laughs, constant ribbing, and a strong sense of camaraderie. We got veterans out here. We got guys with one arm, one leg, and we're all enjoying ourselves, Rush says. I think there is going to be more organizations like this, Veterans and Friends. I think it will catch fire. That's the hope of Dale Jones, too, who says he has worked out a template that other courses can use. He says it would make life more interesting for the players and help more golfers in need if more courses got on board. I'd like to get with the Illinois PGA and show them what we have, he says. Jones can stay unemotional when he is talking about the practical details, but he finds it harder to play through his feelings when he recalls what some of the grateful golfers, now back on their game and making new friendships, have said to him. Eyes shining, he remembers one disabled player took him aside to thank him for effectively saving his life. I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "I had been sitting on my couch waiting to die." And several photographs accompany this article. The first one shows Brad Rausch chips a ball out of a bunker during a Veterans and Friends golf outing at Scoville Golf Course. The next photograph, Glenn Easterling, right, hands a club to Rausch. Then a smiling guy in a golf cart. Dale Jones organizes golf outings for military veterans and the disabled. He is pictured with Veterans and Friends golf group from left, Ernie Jones, Phil Young, Tom Zenacker, and David Jones. And then finally, a photo of Phil Young, who is hitting from a fairway at Scoville Golf Course. The next article, from Arts and Theater on the front page. This is by Allison Petty, staff writer for the Herald and Review from Decatur. Marley Mural spruces up El Dorado. Over the course of the weekend, the latest addition to Decatur's public art scene became increasingly hard to miss. By Sunday, the unmistakable likeness of Bob Marley caught the attention of many drivers as it was being painted on the eastern-facing wall of GB's CDs, DVDs, Records at 702 East El Dorado Street. Plenty of people honked, shouted encouragement, or stopped to chat, said Shawnee Goss, who designed the mural and was painting it with the help of her husband, Tronny. A family from Bloomington even dropped off some bottled water on Saturday. As the artist was being interviewed by a reporter, her design lured in yet another admirer. I rolled past it two or three times and it just captured me every single time, said Jamal Jones, 30, who finally parked his vehicle and got out to talk to the Gosses. Jones said he lives in Indianapolis but visits Decatur for work. He asked Shawnee Goss to take his picture in front of the mural and promptly posted it on Facebook. I'm a Bob Marley fan, but I also love murals and artwork, he said. That's one of the nicest things I've seen in a while. The design features Marley's face, resplendent in vivid yellows, oranges, greens, blues, and pinks. When complete, it will be surrounded by a bright pattern of diamonds, along with the song title, One Love, and the lyrics, Let's Get Together and Feel All Right. By Sunday afternoon, the couple, who own Goss Advertising, had spent more than 20 hours on the mural. They started on Thursday night when Jerry Johnson, executive director of the Decatur Arts Council, helped them trace the outline on the wall. As they filled it in, Tronny spent most of his time on a ladder because Shawnee isn't keen on heights. She concentrated on the portions of work closer to the ground. Shawnee said she chose Marley for his wide appeal and upbeat themes. I wanted to find something that conveyed a positive message and that appealed to the most broad audience, she said. With all the stuff going on right now, something to make people happy. Gary and Bob Laskowski, who own the 29-year-old business, are certainly pleased. They said it's great for Decatur's morale and Marley represents positive themes of peace and love. I hope they keep doing this on different buildings. It kind of makes you smile, Gary Laskowski said. It cheers up the landscape, his brother added. That's exactly the plan, Johnson said. The Arts Council's Public Art Committee identifies sites for murals and then puts out a call for artists to submit designs. A few designs are chosen by the committee and brought to the building owner for consideration. In this case, the Arts Council worked with both the Laskowskis and the building's owner, Rachel Lagala, Johnson said. A sponsor provided funding for materials and a stipend for the artist, and Lowe's donated paint. This is the first of Decatur's murals to be painted outside of downtown. Johnson designed and painted the mural of Commodore Stephen Decatur at 145 South Water Street in July of 2013. Last year, a group of private citizens commissioned the mural of former Mayor Mike McElroy that was painted during the Decatur Celebration weekend at 240 North Park Street. It was designed by Goss, who painted it along with Johnson. A few weeks later, Johnson and a group of volunteers painted the mural depicting the Decatur Staleys and birthplace of the Chicago Bears at 111 East Main Street. Now, Johnson said he's eager to expand the effort to other parts of the city. The next location is the Oakwood area, where the mural of posters pasted to the wall in 2011 has begun to look worn. One of my goals here at the Arts Council is to grow the mural project outside of downtown area, and this is step one, Johnson said. Several photographs accompany this article. One showing Tronny Goss works on a mural featuring Bob Marley on the eastern-facing wall of GB's, CD's, DVD's Records at 702 Eldorado Street. Tronny is pretty high up on a ladder, painting the upper parts of the mural. Another photo shows Shawnee Goss, who designed the mural, painting the areas that are closer to the ground because she doesn't like heights. And finally, a close-up. Though not yet complete, the mural was already making a bright impression on Eldorado Street for travelers on Sunday. And an article from the Associated Press, state and regional news, domestic laborers gain rights. Left out of federal labor law written decades ago, nannies, housekeepers, and private caregivers are gaining legal protections in a growing number of states, with Illinois becoming the latest to establish a domestic workers' Bill of Rights. The Illinois rules, signed by Governor Bruce Rauner this month, extend sexual harassment protections, as well as minimum wage pay and a guaranteed one day off in a 7-day work week, to the domestic workforce, which is mostly female and immigrant-heavy. Six other states have similar laws, but Illinois is the first in the Midwest, and advocates say they hope to expand their efforts into the southern states. Backers say the laws are needed because domestic workers are particularly vulnerable to exploitation. They work alone at odd hours and often live where they work. The pay can be measly, and for immigrants, language and legal status can complicate the job situation. Last week, a Minnesota woman was charged for allegedly beating and starving a woman she brought from China to work as a nanny up to 18 hours a day. Working in someone's home and the aspect of it being invisible work from the public view, it leaves a lot of room for workers to be mistreated, said Yamara Velez, an organizer with the New York-based National Domestic Workers Alliance. An estimated 2 million domestic workers are in the country. 93% are women and one-third are immigrant, according to the Economic Policy Institute. Household employees, including maids and cooks, weren't included in the 1930s labor law, though federal rules have since changed. New York became the first state to add basic rights for domestic workers, outlining rules for overtime pay, days off, and discrimination protections in 2010. Hawaii, Massachusetts, Oregon, and Connecticut also added protections. California established temporary overtime pay rules for private domestic workers in 2013, and legislators approved an expansion last week. But Governor Jerry Brown initially rejected the 2012 version of the plan over concerns about adding regulations and the cost and financial burden for families. Those same questions were raised in Illinois, particularly with an initial version of legislation that noted vacation and overtime requirements. Republicans opposed to an earlier draft, along with a home care association, had questions about how hours would be tracked. But State Representative Elizabeth Hernandez, a suburban Chicago Democrat who sponsored the measure, said it was pared back, amending 4 state laws to include domestic workers. The law then passed with bipartisan support before being signed by Rauner, a Republican. Wendy Pollack, with Chicago's Sargent Shriver National Center on Poverty Law, which led the legislative push, said the biggest hurdle was awareness, since most people don't think of people working in their homes as employees. It was not on anybody's radar screen in any way, she said. Magdalena Zielinska, a Polish immigrant, said the rules were desperately needed. She's worked as a nanny, caregiver, and housekeeper around Chicago for years. As a live-in caregiver, she worked 7 days straight and had to share a room with the elderly woman she tended. As a nanny for 2 children, she worked from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. and was paid $40 daily. There were also safety concerns, such as when a male resident of a home where she cleaned and washed clothes with another worker would undress and linger in the laundry room. At the time, Zielinska was living in the country illegally. She'd overstayed her tourist visa and was afraid to call the police. We didn't think about anything else, she said. We were scared we were going to lose the housekeeping job and lose the money. She's since obtained legal status and said the new law will make things far easier. National advocates said they'll use the Illinois model as a blueprint. Velez said the way Illinois received bipartisan support, particularly with a GOP governor's backing, is something that can help them make their arguments elsewhere, though plans haven't been finalized. Illinois law takes effect in 2017 and could affect an estimated 35,000 domestic workers, according to state labor statistics. Grace Padau, now an organizer with the Chicago-based Alliance of Filipinos for Immigrant Rights and Empowerment, said she once worked 7-day weeks as a caregiver to support her family in the Philippines. She described feeling isolated, working day and night alone. Domestic workers in Illinois will never have to endure the conditions that I did, she said. They will have the opportunity to live better lives. A photograph accompanying this article shows In this August 17, 2016 photo, Magdalena Zielinska, a domestic worker, poses for a portrait in Elmwood Park, Illinois. Left out of federal labor law written decades ago, nannies, housekeepers, and in-home caregivers are gaining legal protections in a growing number of states, with Illinois becoming the latest to establish a domestic workers' Bill of Rights. The Illinois rules grant sexual harassment protections to the mostly female and immigrant heavy workforce, along with requiring minimum wage pay and at least one day off in seven. And from the local page, from Clinton, written by Kevin Barlow, Lee News Service writer, DeWitt Gun Range opposed. Members of the Leroy Rifle and Pistol Club will have to wait a little longer before knowing if they can build a new facility in DeWitt County. The club has purchased 40 acres near Waynesville, with plans to convert the property into a gun range. The proposal, however, has run into opposition, which was expressed at Thursday night's DeWitt County Board meeting. The board voted unanimously to return the issue to the Zoning Board of Appeals for a review of whether there is adequate access to the site. There is no road to the property. The lease on the 10-acre site the club now uses near Leroy will expire at the end of the year. In July, the DeWitt Regional Planning Commission unanimously recommended a special use permit, and earlier this month, the Board of Appeals also approved recommendation. Several neighbors spoke against the proposal Thursday, and Clinton attorney Phil Lamkin argued for a client with property near the site. "There is no easement, and there is no access," he said. "Now they might be able to get that in the future, but as of right now, this date, this time, there is no access. So how can the board rule that there is adequate access when they have none?" Club members attended the meeting, but they did not speak. The board limited the scope of the appeals board review to the access issue, but residents said there are other concerns. "We live adjacent to this property, and we have nothing against guns," neighbor Francis Smith told the board. "We farm there, but if they build a shooting range with berms and some buildings, then that will flood our farm ground, and that is our livelihood," Smith said. Another neighbor, Dawn Funderburg, said she is worried about the decrease in the worth of their property. "I purchased my home for $250,000, and to have this built there will significantly decrease our property values," she said. Ken Wilson, who lives a quarter of a mile from the property, told the board the noise from events at the club would disrupt everyday life for the neighbors. "There is a private shooting range about 2 miles away, and I have been woken up at 8 a.m. from that noise," he said. "This is much closer, and they have events almost every weekend for about 8 months out of the year. We live out there because we are addicted to peace and tranquility, and we are more deserving of having that peace and tranquility for the rest of our lives, not to hear hundreds of gunshots every Saturday." According to its website, the private, not-for-profit gun club was founded in 1974 and has more than 250 members. Officials have said they hope to have the new range in partial operation by fall 2017. Tim Daisy, a vice president with the club, previously said the club has a rigorous training program that is required of all members and a safety record free of any incidents. And a photograph accompanying this article shows rural Waynesville resident Ken Wilson speaking against a gun range proposal, telling the DeWitt County Board, "We are addicted to our peace and tranquility." An article by Tony Reed, staff writer, this is out of Decatur, Illinois farm growth detailed. "The first reports of farming prospects in Illinois suggested it would be a tough row to hoe. French explorer René Robert Cavalier writing in 1680, said the flat lands are drowned by ever so little rain, or were just too dry, and the best require considerable labor to clear off the aspens which cover them, as well as to drain the marshes which compromise wide areas, he added. But what did he know? It turned out that, drained and cleared, you could do an awful lot with Illinois soil. Eastern Illinois history professor Deborah A. Reed looked back from a central Illinois perspective with a Sunday afternoon talk called Macon County, A History of Agriculture and Rural Life. She told a 25-strong audience at Rock Springs Nature Center that the first Illinois farmers were more interested in cattle than corn and beans. Vast herds were moved around to graze lush grasses until rising land prices subdivided the prairie into more smaller farms. These mixed crops with livestock, but there was always a place for horses whose muscles ran everything from plows to baling machines. But the turn of the 20th century marked the beginning of the end for horses in favor of horsepower from gasoline and the rise of the tractor. Generally, a farmer with four horses has to dedicate about 5 acres per horse, both for their feed and pasture, and that's 20 acres of land, Reed explained. So tractors became something that could also allow a farmer to cultivate more crops. Things were really booming in the run-up to World War I, and conspicuous consumption, farmer style, meant building your family a nice home. The hot trend was a big, square, two-story place that was hard to miss. The Corn Belt Cube, they called it. Sometimes they called it the Four Square, Reed told her audience. Reed said farmers have always embraced technology, and it wasn't long before their homes were making garage space for cars as well as for tractors. Fast forward to today, and she said some farms were now working with vehicles that don't need farmers. Jim Beckart, 75, from Mount Zion, one of her listeners, who grew up on a farm, can see which direction the prairie wind is blowing. Autonomous tractors? I think we are moving that way, he said. And a couple of photographs show Eastern Illinois history professor Deborah Reed quoting Abraham Lincoln as a farm state politician who knew his priorities. Also shows another photograph of Professor Reed. Her illustrated talk ranged from farming technology to the styles of prosperous farmhouses. And from the A3 briefs on the local page, this is from Decatur, woman reports attacks. A Decatur woman told police she was accosted in the street by at least 2 men early Saturday and punched, kicked, and hit with a bottle. Written reports say the 39-year-old woman was attacked at 2 a.m. while walking in the 800 block of East Main Street. The reports say the victim did not sustain serious injuries. There appeared to be no motive to the assault. Also from Decatur, RCC President Reception. A reception to welcome a new Richland Community College president, Cristobal Chris Valdez, will be held from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. on Tuesday, August 23rd, in the Schilling Community Education Center. Valdez is Richland's 7th president, starting the job August 1st. And we'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, August 22nd, 2016. Please stay tuned.